Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
A lot can happen in a year. Trends, debuts, world-altering events, and pop culture and film is there to reflect it all back to us generations down the line. What can we learn about ourselves, our history, and our modern world from the movies released in a single year? Well, it turns out, an awful lot. I'm your host, Becky Shrimpton, and this is the A Year in Film podcast, presented by Hollywood Suite. Season 1 of the A Year in Film TV series, as well as many of the movies we'll talk about in the show, are currently available on Hollywood Suite On Demand and the Hollywood Suite family of channels in Canada. And you can find out more about that at hollywoodsuite.ca. A single TV episode can't contain all the stories about movies in a year. So in each episode of the podcast, myself, film and content specialist Cam Maitland, and film curator and historian Alicia Fletcher will bring some more movies from the selected year to life. So, put on your boogie shoes and keep an eye out for the bear. In this episode of A Year in Film, 1978, Part 1, Disco and Truckers on Film. Are you someone who has strong feelings about disco? Well, if you are, you're not alone. North American mainstream popular culture has never really been able to figure out how it feels about disco. In the 70s, it seemed like it was this overnight sensation thanks to the antics of Studio 54, the total radio domination, and of course the star-launching Saturday Night Fever. But disco fell as fast as it arrived in white North America, becoming this punchline and a source of unbridled rage, taking its last breaths at the Disco Demolition Night in 1979, which we're definitely going to be talking about in this episode. But disco didn't actually take its last breaths. It never really went away. It just went back to where it came from. Alicia, disco's your bag. Why don't you tell us a little bit about its origins?
Yeah. So what I think the most interesting thing to me about researching disco is how there isn't one version of that history. There's a lot of competing, overlapping, and very much conflicting histories.
Is that because who's doing the narrative? Like, is that like the point of view kind of thing?
I think it's definitely a point of view. It's definitely a notion of, you know, whether you're talking about European disco or New York-based disco versus LA disco. But even more so, I think it comes down to, you know, who do you want to focus on as an act of cultural appropriation? Because today, when we look at disco, we know that this really came out of, you know, the music and a certain mode of dance that you saw in black clubs in Detroit, in New York, and elsewhere. But then you also have this disco kind of coming out of the queer clubs, especially in New York with places like the Anvil. And so no matter what, whether, you know, you're focusing more on the queer origin of disco or the black origin, which is more the music side, it is an act of appropriation. I really love this quote that James Brown's trombonist gave when asked, I think, on a talk show about disco. He said, you know, disco is just funk with a bow tie. And I think that really sums it up perfectly. But if we're looking at why, you know, the year 1978 would be so significant for Hollywood to really just like Hollywood goes disco, it's because it had become so ubiquitous by that time. By 1978, you have, you know, like Mickey Mouse and his friends recording their own disco album for kids and a variety of, you know, albums for children. You have seniors' homes having disco nights. You have disco size, like exercise classes for disco. You have basically disco reaches all of its saturation. And I think, of course, that's both, it's kind of a chicken or egg thing with Hollywood, but that's why 78, it's like such a banner year for disco on film.
Well, this had been building for a while. We're obviously going to talk about Mahogany in a later episode of the podcast when we get into other years from the 70s. And that's one of those ones that has a fantastic disco soundtrack. And I have no idea why RuPaul hasn't made a remake of it yet where she plays both Diana Ross and Billy Dee Williams in it. I would pay to see it. I think it'd be so awesome. So it wasn't new on film, but why was 1978 the year that every studio decided they were going to release their disco movie.
Well, you know, Saturday Night Fever is released in 1978, or actually it's released in December of 1977. So, but it's the top film of, one of the top films of 1978, as is Grease. But, It is interesting. Like, I think it's a matter of all these films went into production at the same time. And then, as we know, production varies. It can take 12 months to less time, maybe nine, even more. But they all kind of come out around the same time. It just happens to be smack dab in 1978. There's, if you have to think of two kind of figures that may have killed disco, like some of the most hated people in the world, it was John Travolta and Disco Duck. Which, if you don't know what Disco Duck is, it's a great Google search. It was, I always thought as a kid that it was Donald Duck singing disco because I had the Mickey Mouse album, but it's actually like another act of cultural appropriation where this fake Donald Duck like duck is singing disco in Donald's voice.
I can see people loving it. And let me tell you, this is probably one of the things that was like immediately destroyed. I'm sure if they did like a tally of the things that were destroyed at Disco Demolition, their Disco Duck singles were probably
yeah, little
the biggest thing.
Little puffs of feathers were like everywhere in the stadium.
Cam, do you want to tell us about Disco Demolition? This is actually a little disturbing, especially considering where we are now in 2020.
I mean, I don't know. Disturbing is maybe overstating it. But why 78 is interesting for Disco is partially because it kind of hits this falls off a cliff in 1979 when it comes to disco and popular culture, and part of it is this Disco Demolition. In 1978, disco had finally outsold rock music in record stores, I think partially due to the incredibly popular Saturday Night Fever album. And it made people concerned or excited, depending on if you were making money off of it or not, that disco is going to be the dominant kind of musical force going forward. People thought it was just going to be, that's what it is, and rock is dead. Like, keep in mind, rock is, you know, a few decades old. It's not doesn't have the stranglehold it does today. But one person who was affected by this was Steve Dahl, who is a DJ in Chicago, and the station he worked for was actually switching formats from rock to disco, and he was leaving it, so he kind of realized he already had another job, there was still another rock station, but he realized he could kind of make hay PR stuff out of this, and set up this night at a baseball game where people could bring their disco records that their hated disco records. I guess it's kind of weird.
Ducks.
Why did people have them? Yeah, they're disco ducks. Hopefully no real ducks were harmed. But they would come and, you know, the seventh inning stretch or whatever, they would throw these out on the field, and they would, I believe, run over them with a steamroller. It was the main idea.
It's very subtle.
But he, yeah, exactly.
Steamroller.
Well, you know, it's satisfying, though. Don't get me wrong. I would love to see a steamroller plow over a pile of records regardless of content.
But then this turned into like a whole bonfire issue, didn't it?
Yeah.
Like this got way out of hand.
It got way out of hand. I believe the game was canceled. It was a...
well, how were they expected to play with all that shrapnel?
Maybe it was after the game, because even it doesn't make any sense in the middle of the game. Not to show my cards of expertise, but you can look at the footage and it's nuts, because it's borderline riot. And I think the funny thing is Steve Dahl did not expect this. He knew that there was like a disco sucks movement, but he did not know that people were so passionate about it, or that would get so wild that there was kind of this built-up resentment towards disco.
It must have smelled so bad. Like,
and
those burning
terrible for you.
Records.
I'm sure you could link plenty of lung cancer cases to inhaling vinyl.
Well, just listening to the sounds of what it was like.
How about the Bee Gees? Well, listen, we took all the disco records that you brought tonight. We got them in a giant box, and we're going to blow them up real good.
It's just wild. And I mean, I get it. We all have issues with the Bee Gees, but like, that's a whole other thing. It's just, it's bananas to think about this sort of backlash to a musical form.
Oh yeah. And I mean, it was big enough that it affected Steve Dahl's career. I mean, he came back, he's still a DJ of note, but he's the kind of guy who's like, to this day, all anyone wants to talk to me about is Disco Demolition. And it's like, you know, 40 years later, it's kind of fascinating.
Maybe there's a lesson there, like a lesson in your career not to like stage an event like this where you ask people to burn things. That's never going to go right.
Yeah. I do think that there's something to be said that you don't want to make your name on hating something, you know?
One would think.
And I think especially when so many people look at this footage and are like, this is just, you know, people getting out latent racism and homophobia and sexism because this is a genre that women and gay people and black people like. And that, I think, was not his intention at all. Like, I think he's into all of it and probably, push come to shove, even probably likes disco more than he admits.
Well, we need to talk about some of the albums that may have been burned at that time. For example, the soundtrack to The Eyes of Laura Mars. Soundtracks were kind of a new concept in 1978. Before that time, you had either like full-blown musicals that would have a soundtrack release, or like you'd get the score of something. But to have like a soundtrack release for a film wasn't really something that was done. And this is for a very particular reason. Alicia, do you want to tell us a little bit about The Eyes of Laura Mars and its soundtrack?
Yeah, so I do want to have a disclaimer that I love this film with every ounce of my being, with the caveat that I don't necessarily think it's the best film, or, you know, that there's a lot of levels in which it has high achievement. And one of them is its disco aesthetic and its actual use of disco on the soundtrack. But I do think this is a film that kind of can rub people the wrong way. But I'm glad we're talking about it because it's a complicated film. And I think it's probably the film in a year in film I was most disappointed didn't make the cut in 1978's episode. So I'm very happy you're asking me about it. But The Eyes of Laura Mars,
it's such a visual film. Like, and we're going to talk about the visuals in a minute, but it's a very visual film. So go watch it and then listen to the podcast. Go ahead.
Yeah. I think that's the way to... I do want to give a shout out to my friend Hammett, who bought a whole box of DVDs of this film and would just hand them out as business cards, because that's basically how I watched this film. At a party, he just, like, this is like 15 years ago, just handed me a DVD. He was like, hi, my name's Hammett, and then handed me a DVD of The Eyes of Laura Mars. But is it an Americanization of the giallo genre, which I think Cam's going to talk about a little bit more. But it stars Faye Dunaway, who was coming off of a number of Oscars and nominations. So this was quite a departure for her, and definitely critics reacted very negatively to her in this film. But it's a horror film that centers around a fashion photographer named Laura Mars, who's played by Faye Dunaway. You know, she's really yoking in a way that was very 1970s and very disco, death with fashion. And she's immersed in the photography world. The photographs that she takes as a character are actually the photographs of Helmut Newton, the famed photographer who was very, very intimately related to disco and someone who would have...
His big photos were the ones most people know are the Dolph Lundgren, Grace Jones photos where they are nude and very provocatively posed.
Yes, and if you look at any history of Studio 54, which obviously is the epicenter of disco's ubiquity, he is often in the background of a lot of the photographs. It's an interesting kind of nod to the real photography industry and the real idea that disco and photography were so closely united. So when Laura Mars is taking photos, when she looks through the lens of her camera, she can foresee a premonition, or in some cases in real time, members of her entourage, her models, her assistant, her manager, being murdered. So there's a serial killer on the loose, and there's this kind of telekinesis sort of theme where she can actually see it happening as one by one all of her intimates are being murdered. The scenes that take place around the photo shoots are kind of like mini discos. Sometimes they take place in Times Square with literal like garbage fires and cars on fire and the models like ripping out their hair, or they're taking place in, you know, disco clubs. And so a lot of the music that you get on the soundtrack for Eyes of Laura Mars is both atmospheric, but then at times it's what we call diegetic. It actually exists within the film world. What we're hearing as an audience member is what the characters are meant to be hearing as they're dancing or as they're getting their hair teased and their, you know, makeup done for this disco-esque photo shoot. A lot of the soundtrack is actually Barbara Streisand, who, in case anyone is wondering, is not known for her disco stylings.
She wasn't a disco queen.
She is not. She's a queen, but she's not. She's just the queen. I don't think she needs disco in front of that. But it was meant to be her starring in the film and not Faye Dunaway. It was her boyfriend at the time who was producing it, and she ultimately felt it was not good for her career and, you know, turned down the role. But the song Prisoner was like a banner hit, and she really, really wanted to perform it. And it became a very top-rated track on the billboards. But the disco you do get on Eyes of Laurie Mars, most famously, there's a song called Let's Chant by the Michael Zegler Band. I think I'm saying that right. To me, it's like a sonata. It's just synonymous with disco. It's not one of the most famous tracks, but I think everyone has probably heard it in the background of a commercial or something.
It's the original, the origination of that.
Yeah. And it's
disco.
It predates Eyes of Laurie Mars. It was released, you know, a few years prior to the film. So, but this soundtrack did make it an even bigger hit. And I think it's my favorite scene in the film where they're getting ready really rapidly in this insane, I think, New Jersey warehouse on the water with this track playing diegetically, and all the models are like, you know, teasing their hair, and like, it's really great.
It's one of those scenes that I have no idea why a current pop star like Ariana Grande or someone hasn't co-opted it and used it in a music video. Like, that would be so perfect for now.
Well, I think if Ariana Grande could go to a party with my friend Hemet and then meet him, he would just hand her a DVD for the Eyes of Laurie Mars.
And it would happen.
Yeah, this is a film, this is a film we've had on Hollywood Suite for a number of years. It comes and goes. We really like it. As a channel, but it's not a very well-known film. Criterion only very recently put it on their streaming channel, but it was also the reason my friend bought a box of the DVDs is they were out of print, and there was no way 15 years ago to see this film unless you had an old VHS. So I think it's very undervalued and underseen. So I think that's probably why it hasn't been heavily sampled.
Part of the joy of this film is, and part of the joy of watching a lot of older movies, is seeing these baby stars who weren't stars yet now in this like origination form. And this has, let's see, Raul Julia, Brad Dourif, Tommy Lee Jones. Like, it's ridiculous. Yeah, baby Tommy Lee Jones.
It's Tommy Lee.
It's just like he shrunk like
baby,
an apple.
Baby Tommy Lee Jones. Oh, one of his first leading roles. Yeah, Brad Dourif, like you said.
And like
pre-Alien.
Teen Brad Dourif.
Yeah, it's before Alien. And also someone who I love and is so dear to my heart, and we lost him, I think, just last year, but René Auberjonois, who is so excellent as a queer icon in this film. You would know him from Deep Space Nine. He's Odo. Maybe not recognize him because he's wearing so many prosthetics, but he was a big Robert Altman actor. And Raul Julia is at his swarmiest, and he is so good as this this disco gigolo. He plays her ex-husband. And, if we're talking about the actors are iconic and amazing. Diane Flugel, who was a former model, and this was her first role, and she's so good in it. The director is Irvin Kershner, who most of us would know as being the director of The Empire Strikes Back. And he's, again, another director that we don't talk enough about, but it was actually George Lucas who was watching a preview screening of this before its release. It may have even been a work print. It wasn't completed yet. And he hired Irvin Kershner for The Empire Strikes Back, probably the most sought-after director position, film of that year for sure. Like, everyone, Star Wars had come out, the first film, I was dying to know who he's going to hire after he announced that he wasn't going to direct the second and third one. And so it goes to Irvin Kershner based on The Eyes of Laurie Mars. And I just think that's so interesting. And then this is also based on a spec script by John Carpenter. John Carpenter has kind of since disowned it. I mean, he has a career of disowning projects.
There's
that we
very
love.
People more honest than John Carpenter when it comes to his previous
work. And we're going to talk about that on a future episode. But this was his first foray into a big studio film, and not an independent like sci-fi of his own making. This really is kind of his first Hollywood film. So it has an incredible pedigree. And I do think give it 5 or 10 years and this film will be as famous as, some of the more well-known disco films. It's also, I think, a very innovative use of the horror kind of tropes of photography and giallo, and how Antonioni kind of used photography and blow up, and how giallo, like Suspiria with Dario Argento, uses sex and violence and young women. It's a film that actually does talk back a lot to these themes that we may see as just being exploitive.
Well, and the models all have names, which I always really appreciated. They're actual characters.
That's a great point, Becky. They have names, and they're the casting of the models was done very thoughtfully. There's models of color, which you don't see a lot in films from the late 1970s, with the exception of Mahogany. And it's a film that's very near and dear to my heart, and I hope people want to see it.
Well, we brought up the word giallo a couple times, and Cam, you're actually the one who taught me how to say the word giallo. You say it like you're saying ciao, giallo.
Sure, yeah. So, I mean, it's Italian for yellow, so that's why I'm always like, think of yellow.
Oh, that's a good tip. Giallo.
I don't know that, I don't know that we're derived from it. I don't take Italian lessons from me, is all I say.
But you can explain to us what the giallo genre was, basically.
Well, I mean, it's named yellow because it's kind of referencing the old paperback kind of violent novels that were popular and the comics, the fumetti, if you will, of Italy, where there was this genre which was like murdery, kind of cool books that were very popular, pulp fiction, essentially. It turned into these movies kind of through the 60s into the 70s, you know, people like Mario Bava, Dario Argento that we talked about. And it's interesting because it links, at least in my mind, a lot to disco. Some of the disco-iest movies are giallo simply because they tend to be about these affluent people. They tend to have wonderful bumping soundtracks. And you got to remember that, you know, part of why 1978 disco was popular is because rich people loved disco. And you see that in Eyes of Laura Mars. But giallo, the kind of connection with Laura Mars is, for the most part, a lot of them are artists, basically non-detectives being thrown into a detective story, which this is. And also a lot of them involve kind of light supernatural stuff. Laura Mars has a psychic connection with the killer. We don't need to know much about it. It's just kind of like she sees through their eyes sometimes. That is not a major plot point. It's not like she goes to a psychic to understand it. But yeah, using that, she kind of is thrust into this mystery and solving the mystery. It also has a lot of the same things. The point of view of the killer is very important in giallo. Quite often, because you don't want to reveal who it is, what they did was do a first person murderer. The plus side with Laura Mars, I will say, is a lot of the Italian giallo is nonsense, borderline dreamy. It's a lot more about the visuals.
Surreal.
Yeah, the visuals and the music and everything. Whereas Laura Mars is a bit of a tighter mystery, where you can kind of solve it along the way as you would with a Hollywood movie. I know a lot of people in Canada and the U.S. Just can't stand giallo, partially because it's just kind of dreamy and weird. But this is an interesting Americanization of it. And people try often to kind of make an American version, but very few pull it off as well as Eyes of Laura Mars.
Yeah, I think you're right. And it has, you know, in a very typical giallo fashion, a twist ending. And I still think the twist ending is quite effective. And I don't want to say it's unpredictable, but it really, there's a good payoff to this film in a way that I always feel kind of ripped off by in giallo.
Well, speaking of dreamy and weird, we need to talk about our next film, which sits in that exact dreamy and weird sort of category. But of course, because it's disco, it's a musical. And weirdly, it's one of the few disco straight up musicals that was made. It was based on a Broadway show. Cam, do you want to tell us a little bit about The Wiz?
Sure. I mean, The Wiz, it's itself was a very popular Broadway production. It basically took the kind of classic L. Frank Baum story and added a lot of the music of Charlie Smalls. He really kind of created the stage musical. It was an exciting Broadway hit. Hollywood came a-knockin'. In spite of the fact that it would be an all-black cast, it was something that was so popular and the music worked so well that Hollywood was very into it. So then I believe 20th Century Fox purchased the rights to the musical while it was still a musical.
Yeah, I think they originated it.
Yeah. So then things got a little weird. Because, I mean, it was popular enough that it caught the attention of disco queen Diana Ross, who very much wanted to play Dorothy, who in the stage version is pretty much Dorothy as you would expect. Like, at worst, maybe like a 13-year-old. And Diana Ross was not a 13-year-old, but she was...
I think in the books, Dorothy is originally supposed to be like 5 or 6
years old. Yeah, yeah. So it is aged up a bit in The Wiz, but it is not aged up to the levels of Diana Ross. Yes. So it became an interesting sort of fight. It was supposed to be John Badham directing, but he left eventually, because the studio did want to, like, Diana Ross made sense, except for the Dorothy thing.
We should also be clear that John Badham was the director of Saturday Night Fever, so this was a big get.
Yeah, it was going to already be, like, a little kind of a disco-y feel. And the truth is, it's kind of a weird thing, because I don't want to act like Diana Ross ruined it, because I think Diana Ross very much got it made. She was very passionate about the project. She ended up bringing on Joel Schumacher, who at the time actually was predominantly known for writing black cinema. He wrote Car Wash. He wrote Sparkle. So she brought him on. He threw away the script entirely. and just
Sparkle was almost like a Diana Rossian sort of proto Dreamgirls, wasn't
it? Yes. Yeah. It very much is the inspiration, I think, for the Dreamgirls musical, which is interesting.
Joel Schumacher was also a fashion designer earlier in his life. So, I mean, that's something we should put a pin in when we talk about costumes.
Well,
and he ran with the Halston crowd.
Yeah. He was a Studio 54 guy.
Yes. I mean, I can only imagine. He was also like the toast of the town. I mean, the guy that wrote Car Wash, come on.
Yeah.
he also, in a very 70s way, he and Diana Ross were obsessed with this semi-cult-like teachings of Werner Erhard, which was called Est at the time. So it turned into this kind of journey of the self for this adult woman through a nightmare New York. Diana Ross brought along all sorts of great performers, and it makes for a movie that is unusual, but very unique.
It's also one of the only opportunities to see a lot of these black actors on film, getting them to actually see what they do, like Nipsey Russell.
Yeah, I mean, Lena Horne's in it, and she's actually only in 22 movies, so this is one of your only shots.
Interesting enough, Lena Horne, just to come back to the, you know, the director of this is Sidney Lumet, that was his mother-in-law at the time. He was quite a bit older, but he married her daughter and then got served divorce papers on set of The Wiz from said daughter, then had to direct her mother.
Sure.
And to be fair, what is an unbelievable performance. Yeah. It's one of those, like, you give this person an Oscar for being on camera for three minutes.
My God, it's kind of Cabin in the Sky. Like, it's Lena Horne. Like, there's no one. She's a legend.
Yeah, anyone, no one else can come down in a bubble like her.
No.
and you're also right, Becky, that interestingly for disco movies, there are actually not a lot of predominantly black casts. Mm-hmm. Dervil Martin made Disco 9000 in 1977, and Disco Godfather is kind of an embarrassing Rudy Ray Moore movie. But there weren't a lot of black people controlling these narratives. And that is also a way that I think Diana Ross and kind of everyone involved behind the scenes working on the music really affected
this
movie.
Motown, like Berry Gordy's production and for film through Motown was highly involved in this, as it was for, you know, Mahogany and for Lady Sings the Blues. So it is a good point that this is one of the only disco films that has black people behind the scenes.
Mm-hmm. Well, and Motown brought out their big guns. Adult chorus alone, you have Roberta Flack, you have Sissy Houston, who's Whitney Houston's mother, you got Luther Vandross in the choir. Like, it's just freaking wild.
That's quite the rap party. With Sidney Lumet recently having been filed against for divorce. Wrapping up The Wiz.
Alicia, you mentioned he had an interesting quote, because this, of course, instead of being Oz, this is a fantastical version of New York. Mm-hmm. And you had an interesting quote from Sidney Lumet about why this was so important to him that it be set in New York.
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously in all the press junkets leading up to this film and the promotion, you know, the question of how does this compare to the MGM 1939, Judy Garland, Victor Fleming, you know, Wizard of Oz, how did you make a spin on it? Which, I mean, the answer to me would be quite obvious, but he was really interesting. And he just said that, you know, they are Kansas, they are rural, they are white. We are urban. We are New York. We are black, even though he is not a black director, of course, but he was very interested in civil rights. I think New York is the star of The Wiz, for me anyway, in the same way that, which is interesting because, like, the Emerald City is meant to be a fictional place, and you don't really get a sense of what Kansas is like watching the 1939 Wizard of Oz, but you get a real sense of New York in 1978 before it got cleaned up by Giuliani. Same way with Eyes of Laura Mars. Like, you're really seeing New York in a way that, you know, for us born in the 80s, we never got to see New York like this outside of on film. You know, those scenes are like now where the Disney store is in yeah. Times Square. A lot of it is a set. You know, the Wiz is definitely the Universal backlot. But a lot of it's not. And I think one of my favorite locations on this film is, you know, when Dorothy stumbles upon the Tin Man, and it's the Tin Man, basically Nipsey Russell in just the best costume, the best role. Nipsey Russell as the Tin Man lives on the tracks of the Coney Island Cyclone, the historic roller coaster still standing today at Coney Island. And I just love those scenes of Coney Island. And I love that so much of the geography of New York in this film is important because, you know, it's meant as a cute little quip, but it's actually quite biting. In the beginning of the film, Auntie M, you know, Dorothy in this case is a teacher in Queens, unmarried, lives with her aunt, kind of, you know, lives to serve everyone else and doesn't have her own life or her own set of dreams. And her Auntie M says,
"Girl, do you know you're 24 years old and you've never been south of 125th Street? Well, you haven't."
And it's such an important moment, and it's such an important note that the story of The Wizard of Oz is about a journey, kind of like what Cam was saying earlier. And so seeing, you know, her journey to Manhattan and specifically to the Emerald City, which in this case is the World Trade Center, it's really staggering, actually, to watch this film today. When they arrived to the Emerald City, you know, there's this huge choreographed dance sequence with hundreds of extras that required over 1,200 different costumes, because you know how in the original there's the horse of a different color and it keeps changing color? Well, mm-hmm. I guess Sidney Lumet and the production designer, and probably this seems to me like a very Joel Schumacher thing, where like, you know what we're going to do? Instead of having one horse that changes colors with a lighting technique, we're going to put like 400 or 500 extras wearing dresses that all change colors in every
instance.
And they're
Oscar de la Renta, aren't they? Like, they're full Oscar de la Renta designer. Okay.
Yeah, they're chiffon, beautiful primary colors. They change from like yellow to green to blue to red. Oscar de la Renta dresses. It's gorgeous. And this is all taking place in the courtyard of, you know, between the two towers, the Twin Towers. And it's just such a great New York. It's such a great dirty New York. The subway scene, I remember seeing this as a kid, and the scene in the subway, the New York subway, where the pillars come to life is still terrifying to me as an adult. And I remember getting on the subway after watching this for the first time for the show and just being like, oh God, like, especially during what we're going through now with COVID, where riding a subway is a little bit more anxiety inducing and stressful. I'm like, that pillar could come to life at any second.
I mean,
it's teeming with life.
Probably riding the subway in 1978 was scary too.
Yeah,
Pillars or no.
So much of this film is an acid trip, like really, truly, and graffiti, you know, coming to life and crawling off the walls. And I think this is one of those visually innovative films that from the late 70s, absolutely. And as we know, it was a pretty big disappointment for its studio. It was a high budget. A lot was riding on it. It's since become
it was a
cult
money
hit.
Had no object kind of thing. So yes. There really wasn't a way they could have recouped it regardless. Like, it was just, they just put so much money into it.
And in some ways, I think it's really respectful that they had that kind of faith in a film that had such a intimate connection to the Black community and to Black excellence and creatives. But you need to put a cap on things, or it tends to be a disaster.
Yeah. I mean, Universal literally gave the film no, like, there was no budget. You were allowed to do.
Sky's the limit.
Which is kind of classic 70s, what destroyed a lot of people's careers. It's because Fox eventually balked, didn't want Diana Ross. Universal swept in and was like, here's a blank check. And I mean, they spent it. So their credit. You see it on screen. It just didn't quite work.
Well, Sidney Lumet had to pay for his divorce, so I'm sure that came in handy.
Well, I think the strongest point of this for me is, of course, where it started was the music. It really transcends. There's a scene in FX's Pose, where Billy Porter and MJ Rodriguez sing Home together in an AIDS hospice. I watched it on a plane.
Oh,
I was just sobbing my eyes out. The poor person next to me was like, oh man, I'm stuck next to this woman. But it's just like the words are just so powerful and the music's so powerful. And the performances in this, like I still tear up watching a number of the scenes. And when they sing Brand New Day, you want to cheer. You're like, yes, it is a brand new day.
Yeah.
Evelyn is like the best villain. Like, it's so much fun.
Absolutely. And I do really think that the music is what stands up. As much as I think that you can be a fan of the original stage musical and say that there's a lot of problems with the way they adapted it, it's tough to argue that those original songs are better. Like, I think I like the way the new songs are staged, and quite often when you see a production these days, even I think The Wiz Live, which they did recently with Queen Latifah and what have you, is airing a little more to the movie style music, because that funkier, disco-ier version of those songs is a lot more fun, sped up, a little more lively.
What do you think kids would think of this film today? Like, I'm curious. I don't have children.
Just afraid.
I'm going to sound very weird about this. I have a friend who is a black mother, and she has two beautiful little boys, and she actually plays this for them on a regular basis, and they love it. They ask for the soundtrack all the time, totally on board with it.
I mean,
I love
it's funny.
Hearing that.
I like I can see that a kid would probably love the Scarecrow and Lion and Tin Man in the same way, but I don't know. I would have been afraid of it.
Oh, I was afraid of it, but the visuals were so strong that as someone who's was about to become a visual person in my career, I think it was imprinted on my brain. Because the scary things always stay with you, but if the scary part is just on the surface and really there's all this underpinning of creativity and beauty, which The Wiz has, it's such a success.
And joy and celebration and... which takes us into our next segment, which is going to have a lot to do with music, was kind of launched by a song, which is kind of the exact opposite in terms of genre of disco.
Yes.
So when we come back, what does a song performed by a fictional character for a bread company have to do with one of the biggest movie and TV trends of 1978? We're going to find out after the break.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
So when you're talking about the glamour and the richness and the sumptuousness of disco, it only makes sense to talk about a different kind of glamour. The glamorization of the blue-collar worker as epitomized by the American trucker. 1978 was all about trucker culture. And again, like disco, it had been kind of building up into this point over most of the 70s. It was everywhere on TV shows. It was in pop music. And of course, it was in movies. People had CB radios in their home. That's how big this was. And that also brought on the usage of trucker slang or CB slang. And I think that's the thing that's really carried forward most into current pop culture and stuff like 10-4, good buddy. People say that, right? Cam, tell me a little bit about this.
Confirmed. People do say 10-4, good buddy. Yeah. I don't call...
Miss Piggy said it in one of the Muppet movies.
Oh, sure.
Oh, good. Okay.
I mean, she's driving a giant truck.
Yeah. She seems like she's got a bit of a trucker attitude. Yeah. The trucker craze is kind of an interesting one. A lot of factors leaned into it. Why it's so popular in 1978 is a lot like disco. There was a popular film in 1977, Smokey and the Bandit, which kind of made it peak in 1978. But it had been happening throughout the entire 70s. What really kind of kicked it off was the 1973 oil crisis. To combat that in the United States, they had made a 55-mile-an-hour speed limit on highways across America, which is something that horribly affected truckers and how they made their money.
Was that a big like transport thing? Because like, were they being paid by the length of time they would go for, like how long they were in it, or by miles?
They were being paid by how quickly they got stuff places.
Okay.
So one way they tried to combat it was through CB radios, where they could speed and tell each other where to go. Like Smokey and the Bandit, the Bandit is a spotter, so he would be driving ahead to see if there were cops. Basically, truckers became these kind of fun outlaws because they refused to abide. You may be familiar with the stupid song "I Can't Drive 55," or they had a saying which I enjoy called "Damn the Double Nickel." They really, really hated this.
Make that on a T-shirt for
Cam. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure that you can find a vintage one probably. But yeah, they. Their livelihood was affected by this. And I think, like today, people were realizing that these guys were essential workers and they needed to do what they needed to do. And getting around the laws was kind of fun and enjoyable. And also, simultaneously, in 1975, the CB radios, you used to have to buy a license for a CB radio, which cost quite a bit. But then they got more and more popular. And by 75, licenses were $1. So truckers had them, people in cars had them, kids had them. Suddenly talking to each other on CB radio was kind of a fun thing. But truckers were, of course, using it to kind of circumvent these laws, to kind of save their livelihoods. It just kind of related to the cowboy thing in people's minds, these liberated guys who lived on the code of trucking honor and didn't care about your laws or government. But that extended to fashion, you know, trucker hats, plaid shirts. Everybody, even without a truck, wanted to be a trucker.
But that sits very much into that rugged sort of thing, which was also very much in vogue for the type of manhood that people were looking at that time. Like Burt Reynolds was a star. And of course, Clint Eastwood, which we need to talk about our next film from 1978, which is still Clint Eastwood's highest grossing film. And Alicia, you have a bone to pick with this film. Mm-hmm. What is wrong with Every Which Way But Loose?
I mean, there's a lot wrong with it. There's a lot right with it, but... Just, you know, for those of you the listeners who don't know this film, you probably have seen a still or the posters are incredibly famous. I really want to track one of the vintage ones down. This is the film that Clint Eastwood starred in as a trucker, as we're talking about, with an orangutan. The orangutan's name is Clyde. And on the poster, it's him hugging Clyde. And, you know, that drew me in at first, like this idea of, I'm sorry, what is this Clint Eastwood film where his co-star is a monkey?
It's an ape. Thank you very much.
Yeah,
it's
sorry, you're right. I apologize. An ape. And I'm sorry. Also, it's his highest grossing film and still one of the highest grossing films of all time.
Yeah. Yeah. Up until Marvel came along, really. It was really up there.
But the bone that I have to pick is, you know, this is a film that is very steeped in trucker paraphernalia and trucker way of living, as Cam's described. And I just wish there was a scene where in the truck, in which always Clyde is at his side, Clyde is his co-pilot, I just think it's a missed opportunity not to have Clyde at one point wear his own trucker hat. But that is to say, Clyde is treated very seriously as a sidekick in this film. In some ways, Clyde is the straight man to Clint Eastwood's character Philo Bedeau, which is one of the more odd names for a protagonist. You know, there's a lot of moments where you kind of see Clyde, who is the consummate actor that we'll talk about in a second, you know, kind of like roll his eyes at Bedeau's silliness, or kind of like slap his forehead at this really ridiculous man who's chasing after this woman across the country that he really shouldn't be, because she's made it very clear she's not that interested in him. But when Clint Eastwood has talked about, you know, Clyde as a co-star, he said very bluntly that Clyde was, I can't remember if he said one of, I think he said the most professional actor he had ever worked with, that he definitely did get bored if there was multiple takes. So they really figured out with the director, James Fargo, how to get Clyde in one take. And he was the one take wonder. Eastwood has talked with nothing but immense respect and really no kind of cutesiness about Clyde. And it's interesting because this film, the co-star of this film is his longtime romantic partner and collaborator, Sandra Locke.
Yeah, it's not exactly the nicest thing to say, right? It's like, yeah, this is the most professional person. Yeah.
Yeah. The monkey's better than Sandra Locke for him in this film. That relationship is very well written about in terms of how toxic it became. She's the future director of Rat Boy, if you want to fall down a Google hole. But I think Clyde in this film is so, so good. There are parts of this film I really love. So basically, he's a bare knuckle brawler. So he makes his money by showing up to like factory floors or, you know, work sites and picking the biggest guy and challenging him to a boxing match and then collecting all the cash. This is like late 70s, middle America, working class. And I actually really love seeing this. As Cam pointed out to me when we were talking about this film, it is a very violent film. Like if you took a shot for every time a punch is thrown, you would be like off your ass within 20 minutes. But it should be pointed out that the biggest fights, like the brawls that are the most violent, are when Philo Bedeau is beating up neo-Nazis.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Like
yeah, there's a whole neo-Nazi
gangs.
Plot line. Well, and then, of course, we also have to talk about how Ruth Gordon is in this film and single-handedly takes on the Nazis, the neo-Nazis herself,
yes,
with a shotgun. And it's awesome.
Maude of Harold and Maude plays Ruth Gordon, just one of the biggest treasures in terms of actors of our time. Plays, his mother. And you know how you could picture the stereotype of a little old woman with a rolling pin like up in the air yelling? Mm-hmm. Just picture that and like curlers. Picture that, but she has like a giant shotgun.
Perfect.
And she uses it.
Well, aside from Sandra Locke, who is like the perfect villain, because not only is she's a jerk. Like she's
a femme fatale.
She's a femme fatale. Thank you. That's the word I'm looking for.
And I like jerk.
Obviously.
Synonymous with jerk. Femme fatale.
The famous jerks of old Hollywood.
The blonde jerks of classic Hollywood.
Hitchcock's jerks.
Well, she's a jerk, right? She's manipulative.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
There's a lot going on.
Hey, listen, however, she gets hers.
Exactly. But she is also, as to Alicia's point, very clear that she's ditching him. Yeah. He should not be going on this giant adventure. Her singing, she's an aspiring singer. Her singing is fantastic. So the music is fantastic. And of course, she sings live in a lot of this stuff. And then Beverly D'Angelo is there as well in a very early
Baby
role.
Baby Beverly.
Playing a character called Echo. And she also holds her own in this, being the one who like gets them their money when things go wrong in a brawl. Like it's a really, for something so blue collar from the 70s and very, if you will, masculine, there's a really good balance of what the women and the men are doing to kind of contribute to their adventure.
These are strongly written female characters. I think every female character in this film at one point shoots a gun at a guy who's stupid. But I don't think there's a lot of gunfire between the male characters. It's all fists. And I mean, these are the moments where I say Clyde is just rolling his eyes in the front seat of a truck. There's a lot of great scenes with Clyde where they take him to a Chinese food restaurant and he can like successfully using I think it's a spoon, not a fork, like eat chicken fried rice. And as, you know, Philo Bedeau is a very responsible, I don't want to say pet owner, because he really does have Clyde as his best friend. Yeah. The story is that he bare knuckle boxed someone to rescue Clyde because he found him in a cage. But I love that he controls Clyde's drinking. He's only allowed to have a couple beers on Saturday nights, which is just like, I remember watching it and being like, I should really do that.
Yeah.
I should only drink on Saturday. I need a file of Bidot to tell me I'm only allowed to drink on Saturday nights at the Chinese food restaurant.
He's also the ultimate wingman because there's a whole plot line where he gets Clyde laid.
Yeah.
They break into a zoo to get Clyde laid. It's wild.
It
turns into a kind of Porky's.
Yeah. I think that if you can't, it's always kind of hard in modern times watching any trained animal. You're like, ugh.
It's true.
But I'll tell you, if you don't laugh at Clyde enjoying a beer and watching a stripper, you're not human. it's one of the wildest things I've ever seen. And I think that that's partially, it's a very unlikely movie because it was originally brought to Clint Eastwood in the hopes that he would give it to Burt Reynolds. But they they did not plan on Clint Eastwood loving it and demanding to star in it. And it was a thing that everyone told him not to do. I think partially because, like you say, every guy in this movie is an idiot. Even the characters you like.
Clint Eastwood.
Yeah. And I think it shows he's quite adept at it. And partially because he's so good at improvising with Clyde. Because you kind of get the impression that Clyde is sort of doing what he should, but also sort of not. And part of what makes it work is Clint Eastwood knows how to sell whatever slight deviation Clyde makes. And
their chemistry is very incredible. It's very impressive, especially considering there is no chemistry between Clint Eastwood and his real life wife.
Should have married a monkey. That's easy.
I think the thing I love so much about this Clint Eastwood performance is he's doing that thing we know him for, where he's very quiet and he's very steely and he's got the squinty eyes. Then you see that translated into, oh no, he's steely and is quiet and he's doing that because he's stupid.
He's so dumb.
Yeah.
And he probably has a lot of head trauma.
And I think that that's, Clint Eastwood got that about his own image. Like he understood that you can make fun of this guy because there's this kind of person that exists and they'd also be kind of, a screw up.
There's a lot of fragile masculinity in this film, especially between him and his brother, who's also kind of a sidekick and a surrogate character. I think if there is something really redeemable about this film, it's how those female characters are written and performed and given a lot of weight in a way that Clint Eastwood in his own film isn't.
Well, speaking of women in film, we should actually talk about our next film, which features an iconic performance from Ally McGraw, as well as an iconic hairstyle that, Alicia has some opinions about.
I have another bone to pick.
Also should have been under a Trekker hat, probably.
Yeah.
Cam, we're going to get you to talk about this, though, because you're the one who discovered C.W. McCall. Do you want to tell us a little bit about Convoy and that song?
Sure. So I think a lot of people know Convoy. Like, by the mid-70s, trucker stuff had permeated the culture enough that someone decided they wanted to sell their bread via a trucker character. C.W. McCall, who made the song Convoy, a lot of people know it, is not a real person. C.W. McCall is along the lines of Ernest P. Worrell, where he started off as a regional ad character, and he was a trucker who was hauling this bread and talking about the bread quite a bit like Convoy. The first ad is all about him, pulling up. It's like, I was hauling 40 miles and it's other than that.
Well, trucking old home, I was working the blizzard. She is colder than a Minnesota well digger's gizzard. I was up to my drive shaft in 18 inches of slush. Heavy white stuff.
And he pulls up to a diner.
That's going on a t-shirt,
sure,
too.
Sure, yeah. He pulls up to a diner, and it's heavily implied that he has sex with the waitress in this bread ad. It's a strange thing, but the bread ads were so popular, and this character made by William Dale Freeze Jr., who's a ad man, cut a record of essentially like outlaw country songs.
There's 9 of them.
Oh,
by the end of his career, there were 9.
9 records. Let's make it clear.
9 records.
9 records with many tracks.
Oh, bring out the steamroller.
Yeah. Oh, dear. Who knows? Maybe he's got a great song. We don't know. The biggest track, really his major hit, was Convoy, which tells this, it's a story song, like so many 70s singer-songwriters, about this outlaw trucker, Rubber Duck, and creating this massive convoy. It really lends itself to the concept of a film. And then Sam Peckinpah came along and made it the craziest movie of all time.
Which, to be fair, when you think anti-authoritarianism, you think Sam Peckinpah.
Sure.
This is a very weird choice for this. Where was Sam Peckinpah in his career? Like, he wasn't doing so hot at this point.
No. I think he was functional. I think he eventually became like a non-functional alcoholic. You go on. You probably know better than I do.
Definitely persona non grata at this point in terms of the studio system. And I think, you know, to Cam's point, how long was the original cut of this? Keep in mind, the cut of the film as is 3 hours, which I was very angry about when I had to sit down and watch it. I ended up loving this film, which is one of the biggest surprises. I never saw that coming, but Cam, can you tell us how long the original cut
I believe
that Sam
it was,
submitted was?
The original cut was 220 minutes, which he submitted to the studio, and the studio went, thank you, you are fired.
You're fired and your career is over.
It's interesting. It still very much feels like a Sam Peckinpah movie, even with that much footage excised. But it's fascinating. Like, release the Snyder Cut, release the endlessly long Sam Peckinpah convoy
of slow motion trucks.
Oh my gosh, how much slow motion would be in that?
If we're talking about Convoy, which we'll get into the plot, which matters but also doesn't, because really what we're here...
There's a convoy is the plot.
But the reason why you're really watching this movie is for the stunts and the visuals, because holy crap, this movie is just bananas. And a lot of the stunts ended up going wrong, and those are the cuts they took. Now, Alicia, you actually went down a deep dive on this, and I'm a total stunt person nerd as well. I think there should be an Oscar category for stunt people because it's wild.
Well, you know, in an era where a lot of stunts are CGI aided today, or I would say 100% CGI, it's just so refreshing to watch a film that is 100% practical stunts. And if you're interested in that, I would say this is the film for you. There's a lot of truckers. This is an ensemble cast, and like the name of the film Convoy would imply, you know, there's a number of trucks that are all banding together on the highways. And I want to say this is like the southwest of the US. I could be wrong. But kind of defend Spider Mike, who's been thrown in jail, who was just trying to get home to see his wife and his wife's very pregnant and having their baby, and this evil cop arrests him basically just because he's black. And so I started noticing there's a lot of, you know, interesting actors in this, but there was one guy that like looked so both out of place and so in place at the same time that I couldn't figure out why he stuck out to me. And it turns out I went into an IMDb kind of, you know, research dive, because he's not highly credited. He is credited, but he's way down on the cast list. And he's Whitey Hughes, which was like Sam Peckinpah's right-hand man for stunts all through Peckinpah's career. He worked on Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid, on Bring Me the Head of Alfredo Garcia. And he was really considered one of the, like, a really, really important stuntman who came from a long line of stuntmen and stuntwomen. Both of his parents worked in stunts as horse handlers, I think even going back to the silent era, which I think is so interesting. And you'll notice him if you watch this film. So his name is Whitey Hughes for a reason. His real name is Robert Hughes, but he has very, very light, like stark white eyebrows and stark white hair. He almost looks like, if I had to describe what he looks like, it'd be like, you know how in Disney Hood's Robin Hood, even though they're like anthropomorphized animals, you can kind of tell what they would look like in real life. Like, he would look like a mole. Like a mole with like little white eyebrows.
So
he has very, very beady eyes. And the thing is, he's really driving the truck. Like in most cases, there's stunt doubles for Kris Kristofferson, for Ernest Borgnine, who again were all Peckinpah people that he kept with him throughout his career. But in this case, where he's casting Whitey Hughes kind of for the first time in a really recognizable role, he's able to both perform the stunts and Sam Peckinpah can film them at the same time and not have to do that switch out with characters, which I thought was really interesting and sort of a testament to, as a stunt film, this being really the pinnacle in the 1970s of car like stunt films.
One of my favorite stunts in this film is actually one of the stunts that went wrong, and it was performed by Bob Heron, who was doubling for Ernest Borgnine at the time. And fortunately, we actually have a clip of him talking about what went wrong and how he got through it.
Well, I was doubling Ernest Borgnine on Convoy, chasing Ally McGraw and Chris Christopherson in a semi-truck. And I was supposed to catch up to them, and they were going to force me off the road. But unfortunately, they cued me late, so I was doing about 80 miles an hour trying to catch up to the semi-truck, and by the time I caught up to it, it was time to go off the road. Well, there was no place to abort to, so you can't back off in the accelerator when you're doing a jump. You got to keep it to the floor so your nose doesn't drop. Now, once I got airborne, it seemed like I was up there forever, and I was just like kind of waiting for the thump, because once you're in a certain position,
once you're in the air, you're
whatever you're thinking, whatever you do, nothing makes a bit of difference. Right. You just sort of close your eyes and you just hang on, yeah, waiting for that big thump that's that's coming. I went 15 feet to the billboard, and then I went another 50 feet to the top of the barn, and then I went another 100 feet beyond that before I landed, which landed on all fours. I didn't break anything.
Okay, when you landed?
It was 165 feet. But I got a concussion, and I separated a lot of things. I didn't break anything. And I was a little punchy for a while.
I really recommend, if people don't want to sit through the full 3 hours of Convoy, just go look at this stunt on YouTube, because it is just bananas that he survived this. And obviously, he thought that was a miracle as well. But this is also the kind of movie where no one is phoning this in. Everyone is giving 100%. Like, Chris Christopherson's performance is so focused.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. Yeah. And I mean, it's a dark and serious movie. It's kind of a weird thing where it's so much of what happens because the stunts are in the Peckinpah style. It feels like it hurts, you know? Everything seems very deadly. In fact, I think that the weirdest thing it doesn't pull off, which seems like a studio idea, is the fact that it kind of tries to have a Smokey and the Bandit thing between Ernest Borgnine and Rubber Duck, played by Chris Christopherson, even though
not
he's
to be mistaken for Disco Duck.
Yeah, even though he's fully trying to murder him the whole way. He's like,
he's a straight up villain. Like, it's that Ernest Borgnine character.
But he still tries
to
have the, like, you know, at the end. It's like, oh, geez, that doesn't really play.
I think it's a good point, because this is the stakes are very high in this film in terms of, you know, its politics and why this is all happening with racial profiling. And there's a lot of violence. And yet there's these moments in this film that are so elegant and almost ballet-like. You know, obviously the trucker genre of film gets compared to the Western, where, you know, the trucks are just subbed out for horses. But what I did not expect were these very Peckinpah branded slow motion sequences of the trucks and the stunts going wrong, set to Bolero, which is a music written for ballet from the late 19th century. That I did not see coming. And set to the, like, beauty of the American Southwest or the desert, I should have looked up where this was. It's a lot of land. It's a lot of landscape. It's barren landscape with all you see is, like, horizon.
It's like New Mexico, Nevada.
I thought it was New Mexico, Arizona, but it's certainly not, like, Peckinpah Monument Valley. It's south of that, but
it's New Mexico. It is. Confirmed.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Yeah, set to Bolero. You all know Bolero. I'm pretty sure Becky's going to play it for you in a second. The idea of the two main songs in this film being Convoy, as discussed by Cam, and Bolero, one of the most classic ballets of all time, I mean, that's just the beauty to me of Sam Peckinpah, and that's what this film, I think, has flawlessly pulled off, that balance between the gruff and the elegant, like no other. I can't think of another film like this, for me anyway.
Alicia, I think that is the perfect place to wrap up this episode. I want to thank both Alicia Fletcher and Cameron Maitland.
Thanks.
Thank you. I forgot to say the bone I had to pick with Convoy was that Ally McGraw has the worst hair of all time.
Like, do you want to do a little bit about that? And I can edit it in.
To leave it for our listeners to discover for themselves, because it is shocking.
And you, the listener, can join us again in 2 weeks where we find out how you make a Beatles movie without the Beatles, because they did it twice in 1978. That's coming up in 2 weeks. Thanks for joining us for this episode of the A Year in Film podcast from Hollywood Suite. If you enjoyed the show, please remember to rate and review us on your podcast platform. Want to chat with us and find more great content? Find us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, at Hollywood Suite. The home of the movies that shaped the 70s, 80s, 90s, and 2000s, Hollywood Suite lets you experience movies the way they were meant to be seen. Uncut and commercial-free on 4 HD channels and on demand. Learn how you can subscribe today at hollywoodsuite.ca. The A Year in Film podcast is hosted and produced by Becky Shrimpton, Alicia Fletcher, and Cam Maitland. Supervising producer is Ryan Mains. Executive producers are David Kynes and Julie Kumaria. Creative consultant is Emily Gagne. Audio engineering by Kevin Lipset. Until next time.
If we know ourselves, we're always home anywhere.